Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Hi there. Thanks for subscribing to Are We There Yet? This podcast is a production of WMFE, a public radio station here in Central Florida. We're currently in our silent drive, raising money to support shows just like this one. If you value the conversations about space exploration you hear on this show, consider donating to WMFE. You can do that by visiting wmfe.org/support. You can also support this podcast by rating and reviewing it wherever you download. That way more people can discover the podcast and explore exploration with us. Thanks. From the studios at WMFE in Orlando, Florida, this is Are We There Yet? The podcast exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The International Astronautical Conference was last week in Washington, D.C. It's a global assembly of movers and shakers in the space industry, from government agencies to private partners. We'll chat with the host of the We Martians podcast, Jake Robbins, who attended the conference last week, about the big news unveiled in space exploration. Then, NASA has its sights set on the moon, the South Pole of the moon specifically, mostly because of evidence of water. But just how much water is there? And how do we know it's actually there? Well, we'll ask our panel of expert scientists this week. But first, the IAC. Space podcast host Jake Robbins spent the week at the DC event reporting on what was going on, from moon missions to Mars rovers. And there was a lot for him to cover. Jake joins us now to talk about the IAC and just how big of an event this is.
Yeah, so the International Astronautical Congress is one of the largest space conferences in the world. So I think I heard the number this year is 6,300. So it's a quite a large conference. Yeah, it's the kind that you can walk around the entire week and never see someone that you were trying to find. So it's that kind of conference. It's a very internationally focused conference. So you hear a lot of really, you know, interesting languages in the hallways. And it moves around the world every year. So it's in Washington, D.C. this year, but previous years saw it in Bremen, Germany, in Australia, and even in Guadalajara, Mexico a few years ago. So, and then any of your listeners who are, you know, following the space world would probably remember this conference because this is the one where Elon Musk once announced the kind of, you know, deep space Mars architecture that they've been working on for the last 3 years. That was in Mexico in 2016. So it's a pretty important conference. A lot of industry, a lot of policy, and a lot of kind of, you know, technology and international cooperation in space.
Yeah, it is an opportunity for companies to kind of unveil big plans and make big announcements and really get some headlines. And we'll talk about some of those headlines in a bit, but I know you've been covering it the whole week. What's kind of been the overarching theme that you've seen kind of seep into different aspects of the event throughout the week at IAC?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest kind of underlying narrative this year is the story behind NASA's Artemis program, right? So Artemis is the new program that NASA is really trying to get off the ground still. They only announced it in March, and they've been kind of furiously spending the whole year, you know, gathering support and trying to find the money and getting international space agencies to help out with it. And so you could kind of see that in every corner of this thing. The NASA administrator, Jim Bridenstine, has been bouncing from meeting to meeting and signing, you know, agreements or memorandums of understanding, all these kinds of things, really trying to rally support. It's kind of a mix between a space conference and a diplomatic event. That's definitely the one thing I've seen.
And Vice President Mike Pence kicked off the show this week, really hitting hard that, you know, Artemis and moon mission, as you mentioned, Jim Bridenstine was kind of bouncing around, talking to different agencies. We do notice that there is some international support for this program.
Yeah, I would probably define it as kind of on the way there. So yeah, like you said, Mike Pence did kick off the whole event, which really kind of tells you the level of importance they're putting into this. So that the vice president took the time to come, and he did a, you know, kind of the right thing where he walked the line of, ensuring that America had been will be the leader of this program, but that the help of international agencies was really, really important. And throughout the week, you saw sort of the different agencies take their time to you know, make a comment on that. The most important event was the Heads of Agencies panel, which had six or seven space agency leaders on stage. And Jim Bridenstine kicked that one off and talked about the importance of the Artemis. You know, it was really notable. He didn't talk about science programs at NASA. He didn't talk about aeronautics. He didn't talk about anything but Artemis. So you already have Canada has pledged support. They were the first ones to tell NASA they wanted to help out. And we have, just kicking off the conference, leading into it, the Japanese Space Agency said that they wanted to participate as well. So the next big, you know, I would say the big two that Jim Bridenstine has to lock up is the European Space Agency. So they're always kind of a big partner, and they probably will be a partner. It's just kind of, we need to work out the details. And then the Russian Space Agency as well is kind of not very far down the path of locking down those details. So those are the two, I think, that he's really, really hunting this week.
As you kind of alluded to this, Jake, this is the time for these heads of agencies to practice a little bit of diplomacy, right? And you know, reach their partners and say, hey, I need help with this, I need help with that. Is that kind of what you're seeing with the U.S., especially with Artemis program, when it looks like funding for this program is going to be stalled in the U.S. Congress? Are you seeing Bridenstine reaching out and trying to get some money for it from his international partners?
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, the European one is a really notable example, because the European Space Agency is sort of the overarching space agency that takes funding from individual countries, individual member states. I think they have 22 member states, and kind of approaches the world as a unified budget. But the individual countries in Europe also have national space programs. So, you know, if you think of Germany, for example, Germany is a member of ESA, but they also have the German Space Agency, DLR. So you're kind of running two agencies at the same time. And what I've seen from Jim this week is not only trying to approach Jan Werner, who's the Director General of ESA, and getting that, you know, agreement signed up, he's also been approaching the individual space agencies. There was an agreement signed with Italy. We've seen him with, I'm trying to remember the other countries, but it's been three or four other countries. But so he's really trying every angle. That's the thing that I've noticed for sure.
Now, the Trump administration has set that 2024 deadline. Some talks in Congress recently have kind of poured some cold water on that. And while folks in the space industry have also not thought that that deadline will be met, what kind of rumblings are you hearing from the folks there? Is 2024 a date that NASA can make, or is it kind of pie in the sky thinking?
I think if you think about the 2024 deadline in different terms, I mean, if you want to lock in the whole complicated, long-arching program, and that's just the first step of it, that's probably a little too ambitious. What I'm seeing is that industry partners are they think it's possible. They're committed to doing it. But the 2024 deadline, the first mission, that Artemis 3 mission, will be a very basic kind of stripped-down minimum requirements kind of thing. You know, there's a lot of de-scoping to make it possible. You know, do we need this extra part here, or this extra part here? Can we cobble together something from existing hardware that the companies already have? Can they work together to try and minimize costs? That kind of thing is definitely what I'm hearing from, at least from the industry partners. So I think 2024 is possible in terms of having a mission done. It's just, I don't think that will look a lot like the long-term program that they want.
Now, as you alluded to this earlier, there has been some big news announced this year at IAC, especially with NASA's Human Landing System and Blue Origin. What did you see when you were there?
Yeah, so Jeff Bezos was here to accept an award on behalf of his company, and he took the opportunity to sort of set up a little bit of a fireside chat and make a pretty big announcement. It's probably been the top headline for this whole conference. And Blue Origin was in the running to participate in Artemis as part of the moon lander, so the part that actually takes people down to the surface. They are building what's called the Blue Moon Descent Stage. And the NASA contract, like the RFP that's out there, originally had this concept of taking all the individual parts of this landing system, so the part that takes astronauts down to the surface, separately from the part that takes them back to the to lunar orbit, separately from what's called the tug or the transfer vehicle, which kind of moves the lander from this low orbit state to the higher space station that it's going to fly out of. So NASA was looking at all these individual components separately and kind of trying to contract them individually. Recently, they changed their mind and said, hey, we would also accept a single unified landing system. The reasoning there would be, you know, NASA would say, we don't really care how you do it as long as it does the job, really, is what you want. You want them to get the astronauts safely to the surface and back to space again. And so Blue Origin has taken a pretty shrewd move to organize what they're calling a national team for a national priority. And they're partnering with other companies and building sort of a unified system with Lockheed Martin. So Blue Origin will do the descent stage. Lockheed Martin will do the ascent stage. They're partnering with Northrop Grumman to do that sort of transfer vehicle. And they also partner with a company called Draper, who is going to do the guidance and navigation computer software, which is notable because Draper was the same company 50 years ago that did that for Apollo. So there's a lot of heritage in this team. And so Blue Origin's taking the lead on that. They're organizing the whole thing as sort of the prime contractor, and together they're submitting one bid to NASA to do this. So it's pretty remarkable to see these big companies kind of work together. And you know, the most interesting thing to me is that most of those other companies were Blue Origin's competitors. And so now there aren't really any competitors besides maybe SpaceX, but there's some issues with that bid there. So it's almost a lock that they're going to get this contract, and it's a pretty big thing for sure.
It definitely came as a surprise, didn't it? You wouldn't think that Blue Origin, who's been very secretive and very quiet about what they've been doing, would kind of connect with these kind of legacy industry leaders. I would like to imagine what happened behind closed doors to make that work.
Yeah, it's pretty different. Just like you said, Blue Origin, in terms of these other three companies, Blue Origin is the new kid on the block, even though they've been around for quite a while. They have far less experience in spaceflight than the other companies do. And it's funny you mentioned that, you know, that it came as a surprise, because here at the conference there's a mock-up of the Blue Moon cargo lander, which is this enormous spacecraft. Like, you know, I'm 6 feet tall and I can almost walk underneath it. It's really, really large. And then just down the hall, down the stairs at the other end of the conference hall, is a mock-up of the Lockheed Martin ascent stage, which is equally enormous, but it's just the top part of it. And, you know, through the Monday before the announcement, we were all kind of looking at it being like, man, it'd be really cool if we could just stack those on top of each other. And no one was giving up the game, but that's that kind of the funny story of the week.
Well, Jake, what else kind of piqued your interest at the conference this week? Did you check out the trade show floor? Did you sit in some sessions? I mean, give us the rundown of your takeaways, you know, other than the big things. What was really exciting for you?
Yeah. Well, through the week, the exhibition hall is probably the other big highlight. So this is a giant kind of trade show space where all sorts of companies are trying to make their mark. You know, network and make deals behind the scenes. It's really a deal making conference, because you can even see that in a lot of the booths, where they'll have sort of a front facing table with pamphlets and someone to talk to you about what the company's doing, and then in the back part of the booth is literally a throw together meeting room to talk about business and sign stuff. So it's definitely a working conference in that respect. The trade show was really interesting because You just got to see all these different international agencies have their booths. So you walk down the kind of road and then you see the Australian Space Agency and then the Belgian Space Agency. The United Arab Emirates is here, which is kind of a really new space agency that's trying to make their mark. Japanese Space Agency, all these different kind of cultures coming together. And then it's all mixed in with industry. So you see a lot of small space startups that have very small booths, just really trying to, you know, get their foot in the door, versus someone like Lockheed Martin, who had a giant kind of display with VR setups and a coffee bar and all sorts of really fun stuff there. So that was definitely a highlight. I definitely spent a lot of time in there just trying to meet people and see what was going on and have some interesting conversations. And then alongside the trade show, you have there's what's called a technical program. So there are all these little meeting chambers around the outside, and individual engineers and policymakers and scientists are giving kind of talks on the work that they're doing. It's a lot of content. You couldn't go to all of them even if you wanted to. There were some really interesting ones on Mars, which is a topic that I'm definitely interested in. So seeing updates on some of the Mars spacecraft that are all traveling next year. So next year's a big launch window. NASA's sending a spacecraft to Mars. The Europeans are sending a spacecraft to Mars. The United Arab Emirates are sending a spacecraft to Mars. The Chinese are sending a spacecraft to Mars. It's sort of a flotilla of Mars spacecraft going there next year. So I got to see a lot of updates on that from the agency heads, which is definitely interesting. And then I'd say maybe some of the other plenary talks were definitely highlights. We saw an update from NASA on the Europa Clipper, which is a really exciting spacecraft that's going to be traveling to Jupiter's moon Europa and to try and sample some of the vents. This moon is shooting off water into space, and who knows what could be under the ice there. It could be life. It's definitely an environment that would be unsurprising to hold life if it were here on Earth. So that was pretty exciting. We saw there was a commercial suborbital astronaut panel. So this was members of Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, who are both competing to send people to space on these kind of short little hops, which was pretty exciting. It was really, Brendan, it was a really broad conference. There was just a lot going on. And I think every individual attendee can really make the conference what they want to make it and have a completely different experience, which is really, really exciting.
Well, I'm glad you're able to share your experience and your reporting with us. But before I let you go, I have to pick your brain because you're my go-to person for what's ahead for Mars news, Jake. What are you keeping your eyes on when it comes to exploring the red planet? What's the next big thing?
Yeah, well, I think I'm laser focused on this launch window that's coming up next summer. So July of 2020 is when those four spacecraft are going. It's the flotilla of spacecraft. It's the Mars caravan. I don't know. We need to come up with a good branding for it just to make it really exciting. But I mean, NASA's flagship rover Mars 2020 is probably the headline of that group. It's a really exciting spacecraft going to a place called Jezero Crater. It's going to be taking samples of Mars and putting it in kind of like a little box that's going to be left on the surface for pickup later, which will be the first kind of unadulterated samples that we'll bring back from Mars to Earth. So that's really, really exciting. The Europeans are also sending the rover. It's called the mission's called ExoMars, and the rover is called the Rosalind Franklin. And it's really exciting because it has a 2-meter drill, which is a huge, huge drill. Now that one I am keeping an eye on because they have had some problems with their parachutes, and so that one's a little less certain at this point, but based on what I heard this week, it sounds like they know what's going on with it and they're confident they can fix it in time, but that one will really come down to the wire. The Chinese mission is really, who knows, we don't get a lot of information from them. It's supposed to be an orbiter, a lander, and a rover, which is very ambitious for their first mission to Mars. I don't have hardly any information on that, so I can't tell you a lot what's going on there. And then the United Arab Emirates. So this is, again, it's their not only their first mission to Mars, but they've only done 3 or 4 satellites. They're a very young space agency, so it's a very ambitious mission for them to send an orbiter there. But speaking with some of the attendees here, it sounds like they are very they're on their game. They're taking their time. They're being careful and really understanding what's going on with their spacecraft. They're doing the right work in reaching out to partners who have the experience and getting them to collaborate. So I'm pretty excited for that mission. If it's a success, it will be a really big, it'll be a good kind of heartwarming story for them for sure.
Well, it sounds like collaboration is a common theme throughout the week, and which is really cool to see, isn't it?
Oh, you better believe it.
We've been speaking with Jake Robbins. He's the host of the podcast We Martians. He also co-hosts the podcast Off Nominal with Anthony Colangelo. Jake Robbins has been covering IAC all week in Washington, D.C. Jake, thanks for speaking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Anytime.
Well, as we heard from Jake Robbins earlier, NASA is focusing on a new moonshot called Artemis. The agency plans to land humans on the south pole of the moon, partly because it has water. Well, how do we know that? Well, I put the question to our expert panel on this week's I'd Like to Know segment. UCF planetary scientists and hosts of the podcast Walk About the Galaxy, Addie Dove and Josh Caldwell, are here to answer that question. Addie begins our conversation by answering my question, just how did scientists discover water on the moon in the first place?
Spacecraft, for the most part, which is
cheeky.
A little bit of a cheeky answer, but so we know that there's water on the moon from orbital spacecraft, so the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that's been orbiting the moon for over 10 years now. From a big piece of data is from the LCROSS impactor, so there was a spacecraft also about 10 years ago that impacted on the lunar surface in the South Pole, and it shot up this big plume of material, and a lot of what we saw come out of that was water, the signature of water.
Now, it was the impactor, so its job was to crash into the surface?
It was, yeah. So the LCROSS spacecraft, its whole purpose was to crash into the lunar surface. And so they had an orbiting spacecraft looking at the plume of debris that came up, and ground-based telescopes looking at it to see what signatures they would have of different elements. We strangely saw like mercury, but also a lot of water and sort of silicon and other elements you'd expect to see.
Same technique was done with the Deep Impact mission, which launched an impactor into a comet. So you dig a hole, you get to see underneath the surface, because this most of the water is at the South Polar region, you have water adsorbed.
Sucks
individual molecules mm-hmm. sticking to the rocks on the surface, because that's the part of the moon where the sun don't shine.
Mm-hmm.
You have these permanently shadowed regions. And so it can be cold there. So if a water molecule that comes from a comet, perhaps, that maybe hit the moon at some point and the water evaporates or sublimates, mm-hmm. those molecules sort of hop across the surface of the moon, and if they end up landing in a place that's very cold, they'll stick there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can accumulate water in the South Polar region where it's permanently shadowed or shadowed for very, very long periods of time. So that's why there's particular interest in that region.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm gathering is if you don't know something, crash something into it, right?
That's a pretty good technique for what we do a lot of times in science if we can.
Just smash something into it. You'll figure it out.
The Large Hadron Collider, find the Higgs boson,
together.
Just smashing things together at really high energies.
Nature does it anyway, so we just try to repeat that a lot.
All right. Yeah. So scientists have smashed into the moon, looked at these kind of signatures of what chemicals are down there. Do we have any idea of what form this water is? Are there rivers underneath the surface of the moon? Is it ice? What is it?
It's definitely not rivers. And just to mention another way that we know there's water products there is from gamma ray neutron spectroscopy. So the universe provides for free very high energy photons, which can penetrate into the surface, and they scatter mm-hmm. off the nuclei of different atoms different ways. And so that's a way to sort of look at the elemental composition of the stuff underneath the surface as well. So there are all those different measurements that we're saying there are some water molecules down there, but not flowing rivers.
Not flowing rivers. And actually, usually what we see is evidence that there are like OHs, so an oxygen and a hydrogen, or a hydrogen. Most of these signals we see actually tell us that it's those types of molecules, not specifically H2O for water. But generally, we can infer that if we see those things, there's also water there.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of spectral signals that are easier to see for like an OH signature than there are for water. And so that's a lot of what we use is we see, okay, well, there's probably something that's the right chemical composition on the surface. It's the right approximate amount of those elements. So it's probably water.
And a lot of the interest in water isn't for the H2O. It's for the H. And for the O.
Right. So as long as they're there, right?
As they're there. In fact, if we found H2O, probably the first thing you do is split
it
up.
Apart.
So you could use the O to breathe.
Uh-huh.
And you could also use it as oxidizer in other words, the thing that burns the fuel that you've got. Since there's no air on the moon, you got to bring your own oxygen.
Mm-hmm. So very valuable if, you were exploring the moon and want to use the moon as a jumping off point to go someplace else like Mars or deep space.
Mm-hmm.
How sure are we of the amount that is underneath the surface?
So not very sure. We can see that there are some like daily changes in the amount of sort of little vapor on the surface of the moon at different places. Down in the South Pole, there are some newer studies that have shown that there's probably more buried water than we expected. So it's maybe ice that's mixed in with the regolith and the dirt down there. But we don't have a great grasp on exactly how much it is, and there's been some numbers like billions of tons thrown around that are probably high,
optimistically
optimistic. But there are ways to get water out of like rocks and other materials. So there's mm-hmm. probably a good amount there that we could use for in situ resource utilization. ISRU.
And that's using what you have to make stuff.
Living off the land.
Living
so
off
to
the
speak.
Land. Yeah.
I think the measurements show that there's enough there to make it worthwhile. Mm-hmm. At least for a while. Mm-hmm. So there's enough there to get started and do something. It's not that we definitely have confirmation there's enough hydrogen and oxygen down there that we should be able to get something useful out of it.
Mm-hmm. And how groundbreaking of a discovery was this after scientists smashed into the surface and found these chemical signatures?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, we've always...
It's literally groundbreaking.
I'm glad someone caught that.
Hey.
Here for the puns. So for a long time, we thought the moon was bone dry, quote unquote, and that there's just no water. And it was interesting scientifically and as a rocky body. But the idea that there is water and maybe significant amounts in these polar regions really changed the idea of how, like we said, how you could go and use the resources that are there, as opposed to just having to bring everything with you or just sort of thinking it as a place that we would maybe have to use the rocks or the other things that are there but wouldn't have oxygen and oxidizers and fuel and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely water's been discovered on Mars a lot more times than it's been discovered on the moon.
True.
So, yeah, when we see water on the moon, it's more of a thing mm-hmm. than when we see it on Mars.
It's a thing we'll be keeping our eyes on. We've been speaking with 2/3 of the hosts of Walk About the Galaxy, Addie Dove and Josh Caldwell. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Happy to be here.
That was Addie Dove and Josh Caldwell, planetary scientists at the University of Central Florida. They also host the podcast Walk About the Galaxy. Check it out wherever you download this podcast or go to their website, walkaboutthegalaxy.com. And if you have a question for the I'd Like to Know segment, send it in. You can do that by email. It's arewethereyet@wmfe.org. You can shoot me a tweet at @AWTYMars or find the show on Facebook. Search for Are We There Yet Podcast. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Be sure to follow us on social media for the latest in space news, or head on over to WMFE.org/space. This podcast is a production of WMFE, and support for it comes from listeners just like you. Show your support with a donation. Visit WMFE.org/support. Until next time, I am Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.